This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be reading for the third time from the book Wrong Tree by Jeff Wilson and illustrated by his wife Terry Dalton. It's published in 2022 by Cornerstone Press in Stevens Point. And I've actually bought a couple of copies of this to give to friends. And you can find the Cornerstone Press at UW Stevens Point website, uwsp.edu/cornerstone. This is a book written by Jeff Wilson, who's a retired wildlife biologist who's had as many adventures that could be had in 10 lifetimes with every kind of wildlife I can conceive of in the state of Wisconsin. And his wife, Terry Dalton, also has a rich history of environmental work in the field and as an artist and as an environmental educator. Terrific, rich book here. I'll be reading a part of the chapter called Howling with Pam, and that's referring to their good friend Pam Troxell. At the end, have a pencil ready. I think you might be interested in some of the follow-up suggestions I might have for you at the end. It was just after daybreak, and I was out checking a coyote trap near my cabin on the Flambeau. There had been a fresh snowfall overnight. The trap was just a quarter mile walk from the cabin, set at a natural narrowing of land frequently used by deer, fox, and coyote, a perfect funnel point for wildlife. We called this spot Four Buck Pass for a legendary deer hunt, during which it's said that a local gent bagged four whitetail bucks in one deer drive. As I approached Four Buck, I noticed a trail of huge canid tracks. It was a wolf pack, and the trail headed straight towards my set. I rounded the bend, and on the trail, not 50 feet away, I saw a wolf standing over the set. At first, I thought it was in the trap. I stood frozen in place. The wolf was facing away, and as I watched it stoop down and rolled its neck and shoulder over the lure scent I had placed by the trap. Then it turned, looked directly at me, and leaped into the woods. As I watched, five more wolves emerged out of the timber, one at a time. Each one stared me in the eyes, then dashed away. They were so close, I could see their expressions, and I got the impression they were embarrassed, like a dog looks when it's been caught breaking a rule by its owner. It flashed through my mind that maybe they felt a little sheepish that I had snuck up on them. Each wolf was unique. The profile of its face, its coloration and size. The first wolf was dark, with silvery tips on the guard hairs, an adult and probably one of the pack leaders. The next two were smaller. I assume pups from that spring, followed by two larger animals that might have been yearlings. The last wolf to step out was really large, and its fur was deep brown. When it saw me, it laid its ears back in surprise. This all happened in a few seconds, but to this day, I can remember every detail because I was so astonished by the rare and humbling experience. This was not my first encounter with wolves. The first wild live wolf I ever saw was north of Mercer in the early 1980s. I was driving my DNR truck and saw the wolf loping along the road towards me. I pulled over, and the wolf slowed to a trot, looked at me, and then turned and vanished into the forest. Since then, I've seen and handled many wolves and can remember every one of them. Wolf management was never a specific part of my job description, but I jumped at the chance to work with wolves whenever I could, and I was lucky to be working for the DNR when wolf recovery efforts first began. Wolves were extirpated from Wisconsin in the late 1950s, and one of the last documented sets of tracks was seen by DNR biologist Bert Dahlberg in Iron County in 1962. It was a lone wolf, and there was no evidence of an established pack. Wolves started recovering in Wisconsin in the 1970s when dispersers began moving into Wisconsin from Minnesota, and I was fortunate to get to see one of the first documented specimens, even though it was a victim of a car kill. It was an adult wolf that was hit in Douglas County near the Minnesota border in 1975. I was heading for the office building at the Brule Ranger Station when I saw a large animal on the tailgate of Warden David Davidowski's truck. The whole DNR crew was around the truck gaping at it. When I got close, I saw it was a wolf. I was immediately struck by the size of its long legs, large head, and huge feet. Our first wolf biologists were Dick Thiel and his assistant, Ron Schultz. Dick had been fascinated with wolves since his college days and discovered the first reestablished packs in the 1970s in Douglas County. Dick's DNR tenure spanned most of the 1980s, and he has written two books about the recovery of wolves in Wisconsin and his experiences studying them. Ron was a coyote trapper who was a wildlife major in college, and he perfected the trapping methods and modified the equipment for capturing and radio collaring wolves. Our next wolf biologist was Adrian Wideven, who worked through the 1990s and 2000s. During his tenure, wolves in the state reached both federal and state wolf population recovery goals. Adrian has also published several chapters in a book about the recovery of Great Lakes wolves. Ron Schultz worked with both Dick and Adrian and has logged hundreds of wolf captures to his credit, along with a long list of published and co-authored wolf research papers. I heard my first wolf howls one night with Dick and Ron. We were deep in the Chequamegon National Forest and the Bootjack Lake Pack territory. Some pups responded to Dick's howl. It's amazing how good some people can get at howling with a little practice. But the pack leaders would not answer. Still, it was a life first for me, and I was thrilled. I handled my first live wolf with Ron a year later when I was assisting him on his research trap line. It was a 5-month-old pup that we caught on a forest road edge. We ear-tagged and radio-collared the pup before releasing it, using a trick Ron knew to make sure that young wolves could grow into their collars. He lined the inside of the collar with foam rubber, which would deteriorate over time, ensuring that the collar would stay on the wolf as it grew. Ron said that it didn't always work. Sometimes other pack members would chew the foam off, allowing the pup to throw its collar. This time it worked, and the wolf wore its collar into adulthood. Wisconsin had a wolf recovery plan with a goal of maintaining a population of at least 80 wolves for 3 consecutive years, but in the early years, getting to 80 was not easy. The recovery plan demanded that we closely monitor the wolf population to determine if it was declining or increasing. This involved track surveys, capture and radio collaring, and documenting sightings of individual animals or packs. We already had an annual fur bearer track survey, which we had been conducting for decades. During winter, we would drive designated road routes called transects and count and record tracks. Wolves were added to these surveys, and when wolf tracks showed up, the data was sent to the endangered resources wolf biologists. We also looked for wolf scat and tracks while doing other field work and would get reports of wolf signs from foresters, loggers, hunters, and trappers that we would try to verify. Eventually, all this data helped us estimate and account for our wolf packs. The endangered resources crew used small fixed-wing aircraft to locate radioed wolves and count wolf packs to get exact pack sizes. In winter, the leaves were off the trees, making it easier to spot the packs and count the animals outlined against the white snow. Pack sizes varied from 2 to 10. In 1980, we had 5 packs totaling 25 wolves. In 1985, we dropped to 4 packs and 15 wolves. And then in 1990, numbers increased to 12 packs totaling 40 wolves. For about a decade, the packs barely held on, and recovery was slow. My involvement was mainly follow-up survey work, but I did discover one new pack. It was in 1998, and I was conducting forestry reconnaissance in northern Bayfield County near Siskiwit Lake. I was just getting my equipment out to record some forestry stand measurements when I looked up to see two wolves trotting down the trail. As I watched, the first stopped, squatted, and urinated, and then the second did a raised leg urination. I assumed this was a pair holding territory. I reported the incident to Adrian, and it was the first he'd learned of the wolves from that area. Thus, the Siskiwit Lake pack was discovered. Disease and poaching greatly slowed down wolf recovery. Parvovirus, a fatal canine disease, showed up in 1983. At that time, this disease was new to canids worldwide, and through experimentation with captive wolves, pups were known to be especially susceptible to death from exposure to it. Pups were lost in midsummer in 4 of 5 packs then known to exist in Wisconsin, and the obvious suspect was parvovirus, though never proven. We also had outbreaks of canine distemper, mange, and other parasites. There was really nothing we could do about disease except monitor and let it run its course, hoping the wolves would build up immunities and stand a better chance of survival. The poaching was something we could do something about, and Wisconsin's recovery plan addressed poaching with an education initiative and increasing fines for poaching. Between 1979 and 1988, 45% of the known wolf deaths were caused by shooting. This was fueled by negative human attitude towards wolves caused by a history of misinformation, conflicts between humans and wolves, and tradition. Negative feelings spread like wildfire, where isolated incidents of wolves preying on livestock had ranchers and farmers up in arms. Wolves also occasionally kill domestic pets and hunting dogs, and this understandably upset pet owners. Wolves naturally prey on deer, average of 20 per year per wolf, inciting hunters to worry about their favorite recreational pastime. Knowing that deer hunters frequent wolf territories while in pursuit of deer, we knew that if wolves were going to recover in Wisconsin, we had to convince hunters, farmers, and the general public to accept and live with wolves. Our first task was to convince the public that the DNR didn't stock wolves in Wisconsin. We had stocked animals including fishers, marten, elk, trumpeter swans, and turkeys, but wolves had come back on their own, probably as animals dispersing from nearby populations in Minnesota. Convincing the public that wolves and deer can coexist without significant negative population impacts on deer was and continues to be challenging. Wisconsin has a substantial deer population, but the largest part of the herd lives in the southern part of the state, while wolves are found mostly in the north, where deer numbers are more modest. Hunters often blame wolves for declines in the deer herd. Scientifically, it is well documented that severe winters have a far greater impact. Black bear, bobcat, coyote, and of course wolves all prey on deer. Most often wolves kill old or vulnerable deer. However, I did investigate one incident of surplus killing by wolves. It was in 1997 and was reported to Bruce Bacon by local loggers. It occurred on a winter logging timber sale near Lake Six in Iron County, which had concentrated over 100 deer, drawing them into the sale area to feed on the freshly cut tops of the newly downed trees. Although the feed was good, snow conditions were poor for deer and perfect for wolves. While the deer floundered in the deep snow, the wolves could run on the crust. When we got to the logging site, we counted over 14 dead deer, many of which were not eaten. This surplus killing by wolves is not common, but it does happen. Dogs will sometimes do the same thing if given a chance. An effort was made by all DNR wildlife personnel to get the facts out to the public through talks and printed news releases. We knew wolves were controversial and there would be a social carrying capacity as well as a biological carrying capacity for this species. Society had to accept the concept of wolves on the landscape before we could expect their population to recover. To help with these efforts, private wolf education groups formed, focusing on Wisconsin initially, the Timberwolf Alliance, and later the Timberwolf Information Network. The Timber Wolf Alliance's headquarters was located at the Sigurd Olsen Environmental Institute at Northland College, and for a few years my future wife, Terry Dalton, oversaw the program. These groups gave hundreds of wolf education presentations and wrote numerous articles about the biology of wolves. From 1989 to 1998, shooting deaths of wolves in Wisconsin dropped to 19% mortality, a 42% decrease. The DNR knew that timber wolf management would always be controversial, but it seemed public attitudes were changing. In April of 1997, I was among a group of 25 colleagues who met at Park Falls to review the 1996-1997 wolf census. After the data was tallied, Adrian Wideven popped open a bottle of champagne, passed around small plastic cups, and gave a toast. This was the third consecutive winter Wisconsin had exceeded the state's recovery goal. The state was home to 150 wolves, and we would now delist the species from endangered to threatened status. This effort between educators and biologists had proved to be a winning combination. I should note, however, that we still have occasional issues with poaching, which seem to wax and wane with the deer herd and political winds. After I retired from my permanent job in 2000, I volunteered to help Bruce Bacon radio collar wolves. The DNR needed information for some Iron County packs, so Bruce and I ran a trap line for about 10 days. We caught and collared two wolves, the Pine Lake pack female and the Circle Lily pack male. Unfortunately, the Circle Lily male was illegally shot the winter after we collared him. We found this out because radio collars have a setting for mortality. Once a collar is immobile for a designated period of time, often 24 hours, the collars are set to send a specific mortality signal to allow the researcher to find and retrieve the animal's carcass and collar. In this instance, the mortality signal led to the dead wolf, and a shotgun wound to the abdomen was identified as the cause of death. I examined his foot where the original capture trap had been attached. There wasn't even a mark. After the fact, I re-caught the Pine Lake female in a coyote trap 2 years later and released her unharmed. Her collar was still functioning. As of this writing, Wisconsin has a winter population, before spring pups are born, of over 1,000 wolves. We also have a growing, stable, white-tailed deer population. It was a long journey with the work of a lot of dedicated people, but after several decades of extirpation, it looks like Wisconsin's wolves are here to stay. Collecting data, doing field surveys, capturing and marking animals, and monitoring populations is the most fun and perhaps easiest part of wildlife management. As the issue of wolves so clearly illustrates, the sticky part of the job is when human attitudes, emotions, and opinions get in the mix. Wisconsin wildlife belongs to all its citizens and future generations as well. I found that to do our job right, we had to recognize human dimensions of the work. We had to find ways to communicate scientific information that would be understandable and useful to citizens. Whether it is related to management of deer, fox, swans, or pythons, people and their needs have to be considered in the mix of decision-making. A wolf encounter from 2007 remains my favorite, probably because I shared it with a group of amazing friends. Six of us had planned the trip of a lifetime, a 434-mile canoe trip down the Horton River in the Northwest Territory of Canada to the Arctic Ocean. John Olson was one of the paddlers, along with his wife Pam Troxell. Pam was a college friend of Terry's, and in the mid-1990s, when Terry was still working with the Timber Wolf Alliance, the Sigurd Olsen Environmental Institute hired Pam to coordinate the program. Pam and John were both great paddlers and had done a lot of wilderness canoe tripping throughout Canada. Pam had always wanted to do an Arctic River trip, so they recruited four of us to join them. John had some connections through a former colleague, a Canadian biologist, and he asked if there was any scientific data we could collect for his agency on our trip. His friend gave us the GPS coordinates of some wolf dens the Canadian government had previously surveyed from the air and asked us to check them out for activity if we got a chance. We never did find an active den at these locations, but one morning, about halfway through our month-long trip, we woke up to the sound of wolves howling. We were beyond the tree line, so it was all open tundra, and we could hear some adults and pups behind us, hidden in a small valley. Directly in front of us, about a quarter of a mile away, was a light-colored lone wolf up on a bluff. Pam was an expert at wolf howling, having practiced during night howling surveys in Wisconsin. She gave a low howl. We could see the wolf sitting on its haunches, and then its head tipped up and returned her call with a throaty, beautiful howl that sent shivers up our spines. We all howled with the wolf for over 15 minutes until we got tired of it. The amazing thing was we could see the wolf and watch it as it howled with us and occasionally get a howl from the rest of the pups and other pack members behind us. I treasure this memory in particular, as Pam died later that year after a valiant fight with cancer. I think of her and those Arctic wolves whenever I visit Northland College and see the life-size statue erected in honor of her work for wolves. It stands in front of the Sigurd Olsen Environmental Institute and shows Pam with a canoe paddle in one hand, with her other hand cupped next to her mouth, howling at that wolf along the Horton. And that's the end of this chapter. I wanted to suggest that you look up that photograph of Pam Troxell. It's just beautiful. All I had to do was Google Northland College statue of Pam Troxell, T-R-O-X-E-L-L. Northland College closed in May of 2025. I looked up the Sigurd Olsen Environmental Institute, and the first thing you see on their website is, "We are still alive," and they have programs, and that is SigurdOlsenInstitute.org. And I also was thinking of the Isle Royal wolf pack and their relationship with the moose at Isle Royal. And I remembered that the population of wolves had declined dramatically down to two very inbred, interrelated wolves, a male and a female. I looked it up. Between 2018 and 2019, they translocated 19 wolves to Isle Royal. And that's a very interesting story, because when the wolf population was down to just about nothing, the moose started decimating the island of its vegetation. So it's an interesting balance back and forth. So the Isle Royal wolf pack is a very interesting topic to look up. And again, the website of the publishers of this book is UWSP, uwstevenspoint.edu/cornerstone. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you so much for listening.